Well, that night gave you the inspiration for it, but then how did you actually contact women and organize it?
Oh, Women's Auxiliary.
Mm-hmm.
By this time we had a lot of women involved in the Women's Auxiliary.
So, in other words,
so we called special meetings of the Women's Auxiliary, one right after another. And there we got up, I got up, and I told them that we found out from the experiences that we had that women could play a very valiant role and a very brave role, very necessary role, but it had to be women who were able, capable of doing it. We didn't want anybody who had little children that couldn't be on 24-hour day call. And we outlined all the things we didn't want, and we made it very frightening. And if I only had a copy of the pledge that they had to come up and sign in front of other people, because we wanted to impress on them the seriousness of this thing, the great dangers, and what you were doing when you joined it. And we wanted to exclude an awful lot of people who would join on an emotional basis. Well, I suppose that happened anyway, but anyway, we said such things as, if you're a sister, you're holding hands, you know, together, the brigadiers. We shall be called together upon a moment's notice, out of a picket line, out of a crowd, or from your homes, insofar as we had communication. And you must report. There are no excuses for not being in the brigade. So if you can't do this, remain in the auxiliary. You're important, but this is for the brigade. And then we said, and if when we're holding hands, in any situation, if one of your sisters should be dropping cold blood, be shot by the police, or dropping cold blood, we can't have the kind of woman that will go into hysterics. You've got to then mobilize and carry on and let her lie. You know, today it would sound very dramatic to you in this peaceful existence we now live, but then it was necessary to exclude people who didn't want to feel that they weren't doing their part. In spite of all this, and then they had to come up and sign a pledge that was worded like that. I hereby pledge to practically give my life for the brigade and the union, building the union. And
they were telling the pledge at this public meeting.
Yes.
Of your affiliate.
Put your hand up, you know, if those who want to join. And then they would have to come up individually, not come up in a group and stand around, but come up. All right, after she was done, somebody else would come up and sign. And this was to make people feel it was so serious that we didn't want, there was no dishonor if you didn't do it, but we didn't want only a certain number of, a certain type of person was able. So then there was, the youngest member was a 16-year-old girl, and she put her hand up, and I said, no, you're too young. This has got to be women who we can rely upon and so on. I don't know what I told her, but anyway, she insisted. She says, my father's and my brother's, who's got a better right? And I'm strong and I'm healthy. Well, and she came up. And the next one was a woman by the name of Rebecca something. Rebecca Stoddard, I think it was. And my God, how old was she? 73? I forgot. And she had white hair and she was a wiry little wispy woman. And she put her hand up. And I said, Rebecca. And she said, don't try to talk me out of it. My husband and I come from the, I think it was the lumber mills of the north, northern Michigan. And don't try to talk me out of it. And I have grandsons in that factory. And she was so powerful. I don't know if she'd ever spoken in a meeting before. She was so powerful. And she marched up anyway, out of turn, and she put her name on there. And she did turn out. And she wore the red beret, and she wore the armband. And, of course, after they once joined, they wore it all over at all times.
Oh, not just when they were there.
Oh, no. That was all the time. You'll hear Nellie Besson tell you, she was one of the lieutenants, that she didn't know, now she doesn't know if it was such a good idea because we were targets when we were walking down the street. All of the time when you were out of your home, red beret, red armbands. And that was also for a psychological purpose also, you know, to let other people know that there were women determined enough in that city to have a union for the men in the shop. And it was primarily the men in the shop at that point because we didn't have enough of the factory workers. That very often when we talked, we were talking to the wives. And while we were fighting them naturally for the conditions of the union women in the shops, we didn't have enough of them in our ranks. We were usually talking as wives.
Well, where did you felt that you had to have a very visible identification. So you came up with the red pants.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at this point, it, all of these were still your ideas, or were there other women that were developing them with you? But from the very beginning,
no.
The ideas of the armband.
No, these meetings when we were forming it, I don't know if it was at that moment that I said we have to have it, but anyway, by the time that we had all the women signing up, then we came up with the insignia. It was my idea, and especially the red is the brightest color, and at that time, of course, the people's flag is deepest red, is shrouded off down martyred dead, and it was an honorable color to me, you know, and it still is. So this is. I don't remember afterwards once called, if we ever called meeting together of the brigade, there was no democracy. This was just instructions, orders. You go here, we need a contingent here at the Redmond factory. This was a girls' factory that went out on strike, Redmond. And then some of the Redmond workers came over and joined our brigade. This was later.
Mm-hmm.
And a contingent to go down to JCPenney. JCPenney went on strike. We had all kinds of little things breaking loose where women were able to be visible and to know that they were going out and defending other women. And at the same time, it was all to help the local 156, to help the union movement for the guys in the shop.
But it wasn't just serving as a function for protection of the GM strike. It was also to show support of women in other industries who were actually organized.
That was toward the end. This is the process, you know, in a situation like that. Things metamorphosize, is that the right word, very rapidly. And you grow at such great leaps and bounds in a period like that. It would take you 10 years to come to such conclusions. From this beginning to over here, take you 10 years otherwise. But during this period, no, we started out for protection of the men, to get a union in the shops. And then as the other little strikes developed and came into 156, then our thinking went over, you see. And then the Redmond girls, who were so proud, that's a little factory. Was that, they had one in Flint and one in Owosso, I think. And then the JCPenney, those were women, you know. Then we became conscious, as when we went organized, as an organization that was making its own decisions, first in the auxiliary, but then very decisive decisions. They didn't come in and say, send somebody here or somebody there. We made those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hear that the Redmond girls went out on strike, or they were planning this at the Redmond store through Roy or Kermit or so on. And they, as it was happening. And that immediately became translated as an action for the brigade. And it became a very effective weapon. And you see a string of red berets down there with the Redmond girls or with the Penny girls, or there were some cigar. Where in the hell did those cigar makers come from? I don't know. There were so many little things that, that they became very conscious of becoming, of involving other women. And even as, it was such, you know, it was only 44 days altogether in Flint. And I don't even remember how long that brigade was in existence. But each day, its consciousness just went up like that. Until you wouldn't have known those women from the time they came down to that hall until the strike ended in victory. And it was such a shame that that thing had to end the way it did. I mean, if women could have been carried on and incorporated into the actual decisions of the union movement in any way, you know, their consciousness would have gone on. But so many, many times the men said, well, you ladies have done a beautiful job. Thank you for helping us win the strike. And they went back to a sink full of dirty dishes and the laundry and the kids, you know. And again, the conditions of poverty kept them more or less there. Now, we attempted, immediately after the strike was over, I was sent on a speaking tour of the Eastern Seaboard. And I spoke before a number of unions. I can't tell you how long I was gone. I think it was 6 weeks. But I'm not sure. I know I stayed in Norman Thomas's home in New York while I was working out of that. And I can't tell you how long I was gone. That's a crazy thing, it slipped. But when I came back, I came, and Peck O'Roy then, whom I had recruited into the Socialist Party, I had had elected as president of the auxiliary. And Peck O'Roy was the president, and I think I was elected vice president. That was it. She felt like she needed backing. came back the first meeting that I had, and I just collapsed in that meeting, absolutely collapsed. It had a lot of factionalism, and my nerves were just shot. And I was sent to the TB sanatorium for 6 months. Yes, yes. There was no further need for an emergency military organization like that.
Well, you know, at that first meeting when you were formed and the women started taking the pledge, how many women signed up initially? Do you
know? At first day, 40 or 50, I think, was all the first day. And then we called, we had another, then the word spread.
Mm.
I think that's when the first, they had a reporter. And that was the first time we got a write-up. And from that write-up, the next, when word went out, we were calling another meeting of all women of the auxiliary. We had another meeting the next day, I believe. Anyway, we had a series of meetings, whether two or three or what. And from then on, I guess, They maintained the role. Now, we had a hall chairman in the hall where they had parliamentary and speaking classes, too, in the room. I'd say hall, but they were just rooms.
Mm-hmm.
That was called the Women's Auxiliary Room Hall. And we had a hall chairman and usually two assistants to keep that open, too, you see, while we had our meetings. And if we were out anywhere and a person came up and said they wanted to join the brigade, she could sign it and... She was issued an armband, and I think she had to buy her own beret. It was 35 cents then, I think. Well, and she was given a little talking to whoever was on duty by the hall chairman, and she could sign up.
Did you refuse anyone ever?
We tried. I think we talked a few people out of it.
Mm-hmm.
They just wanted to be part of everything that was, you know, going to help win the strike.
Were there ever any political reasons that you would try and talk someone out of it rather than that they...
No. The Lobster Knights were members of the brigade. They wore the red berets and the CPRs that came. They even sent some of the women down from the kitchen just to get the brigade and the armband. And many of them didn't show up at that kitchen group. They thought it was more important to feed their men. That's, you know, the good old American custom, feed your man.
So there was no attempt, for instance, to unseat you from...
Oh, by this time, they couldn't do anything. Then the only attempt was when they sent Dorothy Krause in with the paper saying she was an international representative in charge of the women's organizations and that she superseded anything that I would say, which only lasted about 10 minutes when it was presented to the meeting, and that was all. No, there was nothing that anybody could do then. And this isn't bragging, it's just a case in point. The Lovestone Knights or anybody, nobody could, with the men, too.
Now, could you describe the structure more? You were the captain, and then you had
five lieutenants. Mm-hmm.
And they were from?
Two were from Fisher Body, Ruth Pitts, and what was the other woman's name? Cecile, I think something. I don't know. Those two wore jodhpurs and the leather short Eisenhower type of jacket and big boots up to here, you know, the kind that lace up to here. And Nellie Besson from AC and a woman by the name of Inez something. Nellie and I tried to remember these names. You know, they threw out all of the records, all of the records of the women's movement. And so then they come back, I mean, with the development of the women's liberation movement at this point in time, as they would say, it's very difficult to remember. But the other two were women with no obligations that were sort of independent type of women. And I think that the weakest one really of all, oh, I shouldn't say this on tape, is the one that's the only one that's still existing, Nellie Besson. She was young and unmarried, but she was sort of her father's daughter. Her mother brought her down to sign her up in the auxiliary. But she was independent. She was free. Her time was her own, you know. And she was independent. But she's the only one that I've been able to locate. And did you know that the local unions have run ads in their local union papers? The Flint Journal twice has run a request for information of any members of the brigade or auxiliary. The International Union has run it, and the regional office has issued a statement to all local unions in the area. Any information whatsoever, turn it into your local president, and then it comes. Then the agreement was they were going to send it all to me. No trace. So many of them were able to retire and move to places like Florida. And many of them out there that got their get their union paper yet from their local unions got the notices, but they, and many of them died. Many of them died.
Were you the youngest?
One of the youngest. Yeah, Millie Besson would be, about my age, but the rest of them were older than I.
Now, were the two women who were not from the shops themselves alive, or were they single women who supported the union cause?
No, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can remember, I think they were divorced women who, one of them, Inez had some experience with some kind of, in her family, some kind of miner's family or something like that, her uncle or father or something like that. Oh, yes, they were the best as far as my purposes were concerned. They had no ties, no strings. They could come out at any time, and they were committed to the idea that you just took an order and followed it, you know, and gave it up. They were able to give it, in other words, an order to somebody else. And when we went out in on some operations, you just tell one of the lieutenants, take your squadron and go here, there, and the other place, you know.
And then each of the five lieutenants had a group under them?
Well, not an official group, not a list of names or anything. They just corralled a group, whoever was there at the moment, whoever they could get word to, and they would take charge of directing them, getting cars. The union paid gas, and we had a number of workers, auto workers, men, who had cars, and who none of our women had cars. Isn't that something? I could drive a car, but I didn't have a car at my disposal. So they had these cars. The union paid them for the gas and oil. And these men, that was their picket line. That was their duty, strike duty. And so whenever cars are going in a certain direction, they would go up and say, all right, we want you to arrange for two cars, three cars, however many women they had with them. And that's the way it was done. They were able to, you know, make arrangements, in other words, to get people on the scene and to direct them and things like that.
Now, between the time of the formation and aside from the picketing later, since it's Penny, and then when Chevrolet Ford was actually taken over, what sort of actions did the brigade engage in?
Just those kind.
Now, were you daily on the picket line ready for mobilization then?
Yes, we were, and sometimes we would send our own groups off to the smaller areas, you know. And one thing that I always had in the back of my mind is that I didn't want to ever send anybody where I wouldn't go myself if it was real dangerous, very dangerous, even with any of the lieutenants. We didn't have enough time for training, you know, to go into any kind of a military operation. They put you through boot training. We didn't have any training for anything. So if the rumors that there was going to be some kind of a dangerous confrontation, I was always there. And then the lieutenants would be there too. But if they went off on their own, it was usually with a lot of men or in an area where it was going to be a demonstration with a possible, there was always the possible, you know, attack. But we were pretty sure the police weren't going to be used in an attack on any penny strikers when they had their big customer, you know, always demanding them on any notice. General Motors. The danger areas were not around the little plants. Standard Cotton, was that the other one? Yeah, Standard Cotton, where they used to go out and pick it, too.
Now, were you all armed similarly, or everyone just devised their own protection?
That's right. Except on the occasion when we knew about Plant 9, and on a couple of other occasions when we thought there would be action, we carried the clubs.
Yes. The sock and the...
Both. Well, you had pockets in your coats.
Mm-hmm.
So the sock and the bar of soap was always with you. Or the sock and whatever. Some of them had a what was it, a great big round nut like that of steel with those octagonal things, you know, and in their pocket along with just a man sock. And that would be it. That would be always with you, you know. Mm-hmm. It was just understood. Now, the other women in the auxiliary didn't do that. And we didn't advertise that too clearly because lots of the husbands would go up in arms, you're going to endanger my wife, you know. But the ones that were the key people, the brigadiers, usually had those in their pockets. But the clubs were, sometimes we used them in picket lines, and they were nice square things about like that, 2x2, I think you would call it. And we would tack a little picket sign up like that. But at any point, you know, you rip that little sign off, and it became a weapon. At the time of the, when we knew that we were going to take 5-4, then we knew, you know, this was going to be the danger point of the whole thing. And we had no signs on them. We had them under our coats, and we had long coats. And women, very often, you know, your coat buttoned, which way? Buttons over like this, I guess. So you have it like this, under, you know, your club like this, and you just button your coat down. And women very often in cold weather like this would walk around like that, especially if you don't have warm gloves and warm clothing. And so on this occasion, we had the clubs without any signs, and they were under our coats, and they looked peaceful as Dickens, but we all looked colder than the Dickens, too. And then when it came time, all these women just whipped those clubs out. There was a picture. Now, the BBC had one, but not the main one, of a newsreel that was taken. There were two newsreels, apparently. And one of them showed the plant nine here, women up here marching up and down by the windows. Over here there was some men, Union men, and the sound car. And apparently there was some pre-knowledge, or maybe the action just started, I don't know. And the police came, the city police came, and came right down the center of the pavement. And they had their turned toward the men over here. And they looked as though they had their hands just about ready like this, you know, on their holsters. And when they were giving some orders or something, it looked like there was going to be trouble. We just had the women whip out their clubs like this, like that. And the police turned, the captain turned around, and he saw us. But the newsreel caught us. And that was one of the most wonderful pictures you ever saw in your life. Here were the men over here in the sound car. The police were here, and here was a bunch of women at the police backs with clubs raised. Now, the BBC television has one that shows the women with their clubs partially raised or something like that. But it doesn't show them in the formation as the original one did. They got part of that picture. So he knew what I was talking about when he picked that up. I haven't seen it for years.
Well, between the time of the original battle and the formation of the brigade and the takeover of four, did you have to engage in hand-to-hand combat and use the weapons?
No.
Up until the takeover?
No. We were prepared. The clubs then were used for breaking out the windows when Tom Clancy had... He lifted up one of the shop windows, you know, those little panes of glass that go up like that, and he had blood streaming down like that. He says, they're clubbing the hell out of us or something. They're tear gassing the hell out of us. And he said, God, we can't breathe. And so then, bam, out went all of the windows. And the men rushed over at this point, too. Now, so you see men and women both breaking out, but the women first started the breaking of the windows before the men got
over.
During
the fight over nine?
Nine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then... This went on.
It was still running when I...
Is that my voice?
Yeah. Well, the second one was mine.
I have voice. That's because you're
the
tired of
the market. Before we talk about the plan for taking over four and how the plan was hatched and everything, let me ask, what was your relationship once the guard came in? What was the relationship like and the feelings like between the guard and the strike supporters and the women's group?
What guard?
The National Guard. They were mobilized and came in. What were the relationships like and how did they react to the women, for instance?
Before they took over the area? There was no contact. They had two encampments One is the South Junior High School area, and one up, I think it's another area, Cook School. And they were given instructions, talk to nobody, stay in your own area. They were not even seen on the streets, to my knowledge. There may have been one or two, I don't know. But that was under the Murphy's instructions. And they were kept to themselves, and they minded their own little... There was no contact between them whatsoever. And in fact, we sort of felt that they were a threat because we didn't know. We knew the powers, the corporate powers of GM in Michigan, more than we knew what Murphy's decision would be. And Murphy had to be put under a severe test before he made the right decision for us. So we considered them as a little pocket of threat along with the Flint Alliance that was organized and the spies and the company thugs and everything else.
So, for instance, when you saw the injunction coming, there was fear that the guard would actually try and enforce it.
Yeah, I guess there was. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. We always felt that that was a threat in the back of our mind. But we never talked about our fears to anybody. We just kept going forward. We're talking in terms of victory. So if that fear doesn't remain very strong in my worry about it, in the back of my mind, it's because we shoved it out and had to keep the morale up all of the time.
So up until the takeover... Do you like
the press, please?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You do.